ways we prime pathogens, which have a monkey-see, monkey-do style of opportunism, to follow our lead and take advantage of our livers. One last way to think of an overburdened liver is as the house of an accidental hoarder. Imagine the crowded home of someone who's inherited a collection of family heirlooms made of lead and asbestos. It's just like how we come into the world with livers already hindered by the pathogens and pollutants of our forebears. This hoarder tries to keep his home organized and neat despite the challenge, and for a while, it's possible. Now, imagine that he has a series of impolite house guests. These visitors trek mud and even gasoline through the house, bring piles of luggage filled with garbage, throw mouldy clothes in the closets, carry with them mice, fleas and bedbugs that infest the furniture, and to top it all off, they gobble up his special provisions that he keeps in the pantry for emergencies. One by one, the house guests wear down the host. With each passing day, it's harder to keep up with the housework, and in the end, he's forced to go into triage mode, letting some chores go so he can keep the house from falling apart and shield the neighbourhood from the mayhem inside. It's an experience that most of us could hardly bear, and yet it's a pretty close comparison to a liver that's become overrun with unwanted bugs and poisons from our everyday encounters, forcing out the liver's precious stores of backup nutrients in the process. We're not taught along the way that our livers battle viruses such as EBV, bacteria, heavy metals, everything from the aluminium foil used in the kitchen to mercury exposure, herbicides and DDT, plus its newer pesticide cousins, and more. Our livers, meant to purify and filter and hold on to the good we'll need later, become hoarders of the bad in order to protect us. Symptoms develop as warning bells, and because we don't know their true cause, we go on medications to put a damper on them, giving the liver yet one more task to process the prescriptions in its already dark hour. All of this while we put great care into the world around us, getting rid of unwanted belongings, organizing the items we keep, running air filters and perfectly arranging furniture in the name of having a clean and peaceful home. We have no idea that at the same time we're trashing our livers and never giving them a break. People keep their homes spotless, scrubbing down surfaces and shampooing carpets with toxic cleaners, and plug in dangerous air fresheners to keep everything smelling fresh and clean, never realizing that in their very attempts to purify their surroundings, they're hurting their livers. So that's sluggish liver. A selfless peacekeeper pushed too far, stagnant water, a trash service on strike, a home overrun with dirt, bugs and chemicals. It's not a situation any of us would choose in our environments, much less inside our own bodies. Before now, because you didn't know it was happening, you didn't have any say in sluggish liver. Now it's a whole new world. You're no longer forced to let it happen and suffer mysteriously as a result, because now you're in on the secret. Life-saving symptoms. Before we continue, let's make one more point clear. Sluggish liver is not something that should make us feel less than. A sluggish liver should never be confused with a lazy liver. Your liver will never be lazy. It can't be. You know that feeling when you're under the weather, so you push through the day with that much more effort. It's true of a sluggish liver too. When it has obstacles to overcome, it works harder. In fact, in sluggish condition, the liver works 2 or 3 times as hard to make up for its underactive state. No matter what, even when it's at its most stagnant, your liver finds a way to push through and labour with intensity. It learned to do this when you were still in the womb, through chemical communications from your mother's liver, and it will do this for the rest of your life. Your liver holds the soul of courage within it. Its bravery and grit in defending your life are unparalleled. It will do anything to protect you. Like a warhorse defending the soldier it's carrying, your liver will take any number of hits to try to keep you safe. Taking those hits does put it in a compromised position. For one, it starts to lose its memory. Given that the liver is the third memory bank of the body, along with the brain and the thyroid, this is a big deal. It means that as the liver becomes saturated with heavy metals, pathogens, byproduct, debris and poisonous chemicals, it can't help the body as much as it needs or wants to. It starts to lose the ability to identify, absorb, catalogue, alter and deliver critical biochemical compounds and hormones. It also starts to lose the ability to neutralise those substances that your body doesn't want. As we covered in part 1, many of the liver's over 2,000 functions exist around detoxification. When the liver is clogged or overloaded, it gets too beaten down to convert these substances as well as usual, and instead ends up storing them, which slows down filtration even more. If you picture an aquarium filter that's slick with fish waste or a vacuum cleaner bag bursting with dust and dirt, you get the idea of how impeded a liver can become. Because the liver can't filter in this state as well as it's meant to, waste matter escapes and starts to back up into the bloodstream, causing some of the problems we'll look at here in parts 2 and 3. It's an ongoing cycle. The more pesticides and other toxic chemicals, viruses, bacteria, radiation, alcohol, antibiotics, drugs, toxic heavy metals, plastics, and high blood fat levels the liver is exposed to, the more sluggish the liver gets, the less it can neutralize harmful materials and screen blood effectively. Toxic, dirty blood can translate into dark under-eye circles, hot flashes, and more, which we'll cover in the next chapter. It can also translate to liver heat. Just as an engine finds its parts warming up and is forced to work harder when it's running on old oil that's lost its viscosity, so too does the liver generate heat when it's got too much sludge to handle. This can translate into symptoms such as hot flashes and a sensation of running hot, which we'll look at in the coming chapters. Or if the liver isn't entirely overloaded yet, you can feel perfectly fine. More on that in a moment. Does heat mean the liver is being lazy? Absolutely not. Trying to contain that heat is just one more job on top of cleaning up 50 other messes. Do you ever take the heat in your life? Take on blame and responsibility whether they're rightfully yours or not? Not just heat. Do you ever take a hit for someone, take punishment, take abuse, in the name of protecting someone else? That's your liver's daily life. And that someone it's protecting is you. It's constantly picking up the slack of our overpolluted, overstressed, overstimulated, undernourished lives. The liver also has an anti-sluggish emergency alarm response. It's a chemically induced response that brings in new, vital energy to break up stagnancy. The response is a liver spasm. This spasm can result in a tingle, a twitch, a slight ache, warmth, heat, pulling, bloating, a prick, a stitch in the side, or, much of the time, no feeling at all. It usually occurs quietly, with little or no discernible sensation, though it does bring renewal to that portion of the liver that spasmed and allow the liver to temporarily regain some control. One of the key reasons your liver goes into battle is, as you heard in Chapter 2, your adaptogenic liver, to protect a vital gland, your pancreas. If someone is eating a high ratio of fat calories that surpasses the limit of how much bile the liver can produce to break down the fat, the liver gets taxed. The liver needs to find alternative ways to absorb and process the fat to take the hit away from the pancreas. It's one of the reasons why the liver must be adaptogenic. The more the liver gets beaten down, the more its glucose reserves drop and drop and drop. When the liver doesn't have enough glucose in reserve, it can't release it to the pancreas to stop the insulin resistance process. As a result, your doctor may say your A1C levels are elevated or even off the charts, resulting in a diagnosis of prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. We'll get to that in Chapter 15. Diabetes and blood sugar imbalance. Your liver is so responsible for the pancreas that it also releases a chemical compound just for the gland. A band-aid chemical signature to the pancreas to help mend and heal wounds there. Another precious part of you that your liver is trying to protect is your heart. Your liver processes and filters toxins out of your blood so that your heart doesn't become asphyxiated from poisons crowding out oxygen, so that plaque doesn't build up in the heart's valves or in the arteries, and to thin the blood so the heart doesn't have to work as hard. There's so much more that can happen when the liver is under too much stress. Scarring, cysts, tumours, a weakened immune system, enlargement, inflammation, all of which we'll cover in the coming chapters. It's also common to have a sluggish liver and experience no symptoms at all for a long time. That's another miracle of the liver. It will hold out, shielding you from its burden for as long as it possibly can. You probably know the feeling, what it's like to be faced with endless tasks while coming under siege from all angles, and yet not wanting to let down anyone in your life by showing how much you're struggling. You soldier on, doing as much work as you can without complaint, and only when it's physically impossible to keep it up anymore do you make a peep. The liver's soldiering on is why it's very common for people not to exhibit their first symptoms of sluggish liver until their late 30s or into their 40s, at which point, in women, it's often mistaken for menopause. What seems like the sudden onset of hot flashes, irritability and insomnia actually isn't sudden at all. It's the result of a lifetime of sluggish liver building up and up and up and just now making itself known after decades. This remains unknown to medical research and science due to the hormone replacement mass market and the hormone blame that to this day keeps women in the dark about what's really causing their symptoms. Exactly how the liver becomes silently burdened depends on each individual's life circumstances. There are different combinations for everyone. Sluggish liver can be a result of a long-term, chronic and low-grade infection of EBV, for example, or a low-grade infection from any one of a number of other viruses. The liver can be sluggish from toxic heavy metals that have gathered along the way, from prescription pharmaceuticals taken periodically, from celebratory alcohol imbibed over many gatherings, from a few decades of unhealthy, fatty foods, from tons of coffee, lattes and cappuccinos, and from many emotional ups and downs that have triggered the adrenals to saturate the liver with adrenaline due to fight or flight responses throughout your lifetime. No matter which particular challenges your liver faced, it miraculously built bridges and died out fires over the years, protecting you from all manner of threats and preventing you from suffering. Then, finally, the day came when it couldn't cope on its own anymore. It gave you symptoms. Night sweats and brain fog. A bad night's sleep, a small bout of rosacea or eczema, for example, as a cry for help, hoping that someday you would be able to understand what was going on and offer relief. The world isn't there yet. Symptoms and illnesses aren't properly linked to the liver, never mind to the unknown condition sluggish liver. We think of symptoms as pesky, as signs of our bodies turning against us, when in reality they're incredibly helpful clues about something going wrong deep within. We don't get annoyed at smoke, saying that it's a sign of the air having it in for us that day. Rather, we know that smoke is a sign of fire. So we give thanks for the signal and follow it to its source. 5 varieties of sluggish liver. Just as different types of smoke can alert us to different types of fires, particular symptoms can clue us in to what's wrong with the liver. One way to help figure out what's going on is to learn about the 5 varieties of sluggish liver. That's right, sluggish liver is not all or nothing. The whole liver doesn't become sluggish at once. It may be only part of your liver that's sluggish, while the rest functions fine. Many people have a combination of sluggish areas. Here's a look at the 5 areas of liver sluggishness. Keep in mind that you could have a sluggish liver in one or even all 5 of these areas and not experience a single one of these symptoms. Middle of the liver. A liver that's sluggish in its deepest part is most likely to reveal itself with symptoms such as hot flashes, night sweats, pre-diabetes, swelling, fluid retention, body temperature fluctuations, low energy, weight gain, brain fog, dark circles under the eyes, hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia, fatigue, rashes, anger, frustration, irritability, a sense of loneliness, depression, anxiety, anxiousness, poor skin tone, skin pigment issues, including Raynaud's syndrome, and excessive thirst. Bottom of the liver. A sluggish lower liver can make you toss and turn in the night, result in other sleep disturbances and insomnia, and or give you constipation, a feeling of unease, sensations of hot and cold when neither make sense for your environment, jealousy, or quick-to-get-hurt manner that gets you labelled as having a thin skin. Top of the liver. Poor digestion, acid reflux, bloating, gastritis, pressure in the abdomen, irritability, frustration, stiff shoulder, shoulder ache, tongue sores, canker sores, corner of the lip sores, other mouth sores, body temperature fluctuations, and a bulging, protruding or hardened upper belly are all possible symptoms of a sluggish upper liver. Left side of the liver. When the left-hand side, the left lobe of the liver, is sluggish, feelings of weakness in the left leg or arm, nausea, anxiousness, lack of hunger, insatiable hunger, random stomach pain, moodiness, irritability, emotional sensitivities, and backaches can result. right side of the liver. The right hand, larger side, the right lobe, of the liver becoming sluggish can lead to brittle and or discoloured nails from zinc deficiency, stitches in the right hand ribs, mild weakness on the right side of the body, leg spasms or cramps, mild tongue discoloration, a raw tip of the tongue, sensations of inexplicable hot and cold, and difficulty warming up. Cracking the code. Put another way, symptoms are like a foreign language, one none of us learned in school or even at home. It's our job to interpret for the body, in this case, the liver, so that it can finally get its point across. So many of the symptoms and illnesses that the world teaches us are signs of a faulty body are, in fact, a sluggish or damaged liver asking for assistance. If you experience fatigue, the doctor may say it's because you're too stressed out, when really it could be an infection of EBV inside the liver. If you experience hot flashes, you'll hear that it's hormonal and a sign of perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. When the truth is that they happen as a result of a liver that's been holding on to a virus, heavy metals, or toxins long term. With mysterious weight gain, a practitioner may say that you overeat or you don't eat right, or you need to exercise more. Meanwhile, it's really a sign of a liver burdened with viruses, excess adrenaline, and other troublemakers. And if acne plagues you, the diagnosis will be puberty or another hormonal shift, when the reality is that it's from strep bacteria thriving in a congested liver, causing the lymphatic system to become overloaded too. None of these issues mean your body is falling apart. They're your liver saying, "Please help me." This part of the audiobook, The Unseen Storm, is all about interpreting what our livers are trying to tell us. It's about tracing the smoke to the fire. It's about decoding the puzzling messages that most of the time we don't even realise are coming from our livers, so that we can finally move forward. In the coming chapters, we'll take a more in-depth look at liver-related symptoms and conditions, some of which you'd expect, such as hepatitis, and others you may not connect with the liver, such as prediabetes, eczema, psoriasis, and SIBO. No longer do you have to dislike or distrust your body. It's not out to get you. It's not letting you down. It's not weak. Your body is on your side. Let's stop thinking of the health problems we're about to look at as genetic life sentences, as our bodies disappointing us, or as autoimmune ticking time bombs that self-detonate beyond our control. Let's start seeing the hidden blessing that the liver cries out for help. After all, when the liver shows its struggle, it gives us the opportunity to respond, to bring it back to health, and to reclaim our lives. Chapter 9. Liver Enzyme Guess Tests. Say a man named Noah goes to the doctor for a routine physical. The doctor draws some blood, and several days later, Noah receives a call saying the blood work came back from the lab. "Your liver enzymes are elevated," the doctor tells him. "What does that mean?" Noah asks. "Why don't you come in? I'll run some additional tests, and we'll talk about it." When Noah arrives for his appointment, he asks again, "What does it mean to have elevated liver enzymes?" This time the doctor says, "Well, we really don't know. We just know that it indicates something is going on with the liver. It could be liver damage." "How could I have damaged my liver?" "It could be a liver condition or a disease developing, although you seem very healthy on other counts, so I doubt that. Do you consume a lot of alcohol? Are you under a lot of stress? Look, Noah, it might not be anything at all, or it could be inflamed liver cells. We'll have to take some more blood and run some more tests. Thousands like Noah go through this experience of mystery, elevated liver enzymes. It's obvious that something's going on with the liver, though no one, including the experts, knows precisely what. One common outcome would be if Noah received a CT or a PET scan, MRI and ultrasound of his liver, none of them displaying any problems worth investigating further. With no reason to biopsy the liver, Noah would receive the instructions, eat a little better, keep your stress in check, and get more sleep. Come back in 3 months and we'll test it again. Another possible outcome would be if Noah did have something apparent on one of his scans, such as extreme visible inflammation, scar tissue, or cystic activity. Then, in the doctor's eyes, there would be a match for why the liver enzymes were elevated. Many cases are like the first one, where liver enzymes are elevated with no real indication otherwise of a problem. This leads medical research and science to believe that an enzyme test is a guessing game, fallible and inaccurate. There are cases where someone has a cyst or scar tissue and an enzyme test comes back normal. You could have a fatty liver too, with enzymes either elevated or not. Even when scans show something visible happening to someone's liver, an enzyme test doesn't say what it is or what to do about it. That's why the title of this chapter is Liver Enzyme Guess Tests. Here, we'll explore what's really happening when liver enzymes are released and how these tests are still valuable, even though they're not the be-all and end-all. I don't want to devalue liver enzyme tests because I do think they have their place. One of the many items graduates aren't given when they finish medical school is an oracle. Instead, they need to work with what is available within their means. So really, it's a miracle that we have liver tests to help them along. These tests are important indicators that give doctors permission to go with the gut and use some intuition in giving guidance to their patients. What I like most about liver enzyme tests is that they make doctors and patients aware that there could be a liver problem when otherwise they'd have no idea. When people hear that they have elevated liver enzymes, it's a signal to some of them to change their lifestyles. It's that prompt for the doctor to tell Noah to take better care of himself. Chances are, Noah is going to think more about what he eats now, even lowering his chances of a heart attack. Even if his doctor or a trendy article gives him the wrong direction about what to eat, he'll likely end up getting some more productive food in himself one way or another, and he'll be a little more mindful about his health. That's worth a lot. The real meaning of enzymes. The two enzymes most commonly tested for are alanine transaminase, ALT, and aspartate aminotransferase, AST. Other common enzymes tested for are alkaline phosphatase, ALP, and gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase, GGT. Doctors also commonly order blood tests to analyze levels of albumin, a blood protein that's believed to transport important nutritional components and possibly hormones throughout the bloodstream. If a test comes back showing you have low albumin, chances are the doctor will think you're eating poorly. Medical research and science believe it's an indicator of bad nutrition. If it comes back high, then medical communities use it as license to move forward with further investigation into whether something, somewhere could be wrong in the body, such as a bacterial infection or an injury of some kind. Like the enzyme tests, this one doesn't pinpoint anything.
What elevated albumin really indicates is a viral flare.
Doctors may also find elevated bilirubin in the bloodstream. Bilirubin is created when the liver breaks down and detoxifies red blood cells. There are two kinds of bilirubin, one created within the liver itself and one that's floating through the bloodstream that the liver must collect and convert so it can be used as viable liver bilirubin. If bilirubin is elevated in your blood work, it can indicate a pancreatic problem, a liver condition developing, a bile duct issue, or even a tumour in the bile duct. All of these tests are accurate, in that when the results are abnormal, there's a very good chance that something is wrong with the liver, though what that is often remains completely unknown to medical communities. While today's liver testing can catch problems before they're at their worst, it doesn't catch problems at their earliest. When any liver testing indicates a problem, it really means that the patient was dealing with the liver condition long, long before testing showed anything. If an adult's test results show elevated enzymes or bilirubin, it usually means that something could have taken root in the liver way back, 10 or 30 years ago, or even longer. Sluggishness, an old viral infection, so-called autoimmune inflammation, the early stages of hepatitis C, or another issue, could have started to develop decades ago. For an infant or a child, it's a different story. Refer to Chapter 28 for information on juvenile liver problems. The only reason that a liver problem would show up quickly on an adult's test would be if it's an acute infection. To diagnose that, doctors would also go by inflammation rising fast within the liver, as well as other signs of the immune system reacting to an infection, such as elevated white count and symptoms such as fever, weakness, nausea, or skin discoloration. The tests remain basic. When future tests are invented way down the road, then they will pick up on early signs of liver problems, because there is more to detect. For example, there are more than 4 enzymes that show up in the blood as indicators. There are dozens of undiscovered enzymes. There are also hundreds of chemical compounds yet to be discovered that will help medical professionals identify definitively what's really happening in the liver and where. Is it hepatitis A, B, C, D, E? Or one of the numerous other forms of hepatitis that medicine will eventually identify? More on hepatitis in Chapter 29. Are pesticides and herbicides building up in the liver and hampering it? Future testing will be able to determine these answers because the enzymes and chemical compounds that the liver releases are special. Specific signals. Each enzyme and chemical compound holds a cipher. For true progress, it will take a bridge to connect the medical establishment with the land of honesty. This will mean the medical world acknowledging the prevalence of toxic heavy metals and where they come from, as well as how dangerous the herbicides, fungicides, and pesticides we encounter in our everyday lives, such as mosquito sprays dropped from the sky, are to the liver. Once this honesty develops, the door may finally open to discovering the enzymes and chemical compounds that the liver sends as flares. Only then will researchers discover that certain liver enzyme emergency flares actually contain information that illuminates why they're being released. They'll decode how certain flares signal certain insecticides, while others match mercury and aluminum. that every toxin and every pathogen has a connection to a different liver enzyme coating, and that far from random, they actually create a comprehensive picture of the particular struggles of someone's individual liver. Research and science aren't allowed to go there yet. Connecting those dots would mean exposing the influence of the pesticide world and the heavy metal world. It would mean being honest about the industries that put these into our everyday lives and how the medical machine is hand in hand with them. It's well known, for example, that drugs and pharmaceuticals can contain heavy metals. So how can we build the bridge yet to their effects on the liver? Pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides too have ties to the medical industry. Another reason why we can't build the bridge yet. We won't be allowed to go there for a very long time. It will take a major shift for a doctor to be given the data and training to be able to say, wow, this one enzyme is signalling that your liver is dealing with a virus. And hey, wait a minute. This other enzyme is triggered by a chemical in fungicides that's used on all kinds of products. And here's another enzyme coming from insecticides that your town drops to control the mosquito population. It's better for medical industry relationships that we stay in the dark. You've got high liver enzymes? Let's never study which one's coming from what. By the way, we just touched on one reason why the liver releases enzymes when it's inflamed or damaged, as emergency flares. If you were having trouble out at sea, the captain of your ship would shoot off a flare gun in the hope that someone would see and come to the rescue. Your liver's enzymes and their coatings are even more specialized than that. Its signals are like a boat sending up a red flare if it started to sink, an orange flare if it got stranded far from land, and a purple flare if pirates attacked. Whose attention is the liver trying to catch, though? Not the doctor's. Unlike when you take your poodle to the vet and the dog can see what's going on and tell that the vet is trying to help, the liver doesn't have eyes. It doesn't even know what doctors are. What the liver knows is how you work internally. The flares in the form of enzymes and chemical compounds are for other parts of the body to receive. They're warnings to other organs and glands that a liver condition is occurring. While symptoms and conditions are clues to you that the liver is hurting, the liver's enzymes and chemical compounds are clues to the rest of the body. The beauty is that when medical research and science eventually discover the various meanings of these emissions, they'll be able to read the liver's signals, just as the body can. In the meantime, today's blood tests pick up on only a tiny fraction of what's happening. For comparison, think of a sample of stagnant pond water. We know this stagnant water is probably infested with hundreds of problematic contaminants, among them parasites, bacteria, unproductive fungi and algae, amoebas, protozoa, and environmental toxins. Now, imagine if the water test came back showing that there were only four very similar microbes and that otherwise it was fine to drink. You wouldn't trust the results, because the state of water testing is further along than that. You'd know it was one shoddy test, and that another sample would need to be taken and evaluated to get the real picture. And yet, the incomplete picture is the stage we're still at with blood testing for all chronic health conditions. We can look at it as a glass half empty, that we're that far behind, or glass half full of contaminated water, that we're not yet far enough along. Back to the enzymes and chemical compounds. Signals from the liver are not only cries for help, they're little blessings. messages to the other parts of the body to self-prepare. One of the organs they signal is the brain. They provide critical messages to the central nervous system. It would be awesome if they were messages that took control and got us to drink more celery juice. In reality, they're even better and, in fact, miraculous. These communications that we can't feel or see are directions to the nervous system to support the liver. For the adrenals, the signals forewarn them that there's a problem brewing. So the glands should slow down their engines a bit. The pancreas also gets a message to be mindful of its enzymatic output. The digestive enzymes produced by the pancreas are not to be confused with the liver's warning enzymes. After signalling, the liver's enzymes and undiscovered chemical compounds have a second active role, a job they're assigned upon release, and that's to act as cleaning agents and devour toxic substances that are still active. That is, when a toxic substance does damage to the liver and then escapes, the enzymes and compounds are released with license to hunt down the escaped particles, chemicals, and toxins, feverishly seeking them out like scavengers and devouring them. Essentially, the enzymes neutralize what the liver and its perim cells couldn't because the liver had become too stagnant, sluggish, or overburdened. This is an important point to revisit. Usually the liver will only release waste items if they've been disarmed and inactivated. The liver has a self-monitoring and self-collecting ability. It can choose what garbage it wants to package and release to the bloodstream for exit through the colon or kidneys, or to send through the bile to the gallbladder. That is, unless the liver is slowing down and can't perform its normal functions, if the liver is sluggish and some troublemakers escape without being disarmed, that's when it sends its liver enzymes to go chase after the unneutralized particles. When a rogue virus, such as EBV or HHV6, is in residence in the liver, producing neurotoxins and other poisonous waste, that's another time when the liver will call on its enzymes. While a stronger liver will disarm neurotoxins to a degree, even a disarmed neurotoxin remains toxic. A weaker liver has an even harder time neutralizing neurotoxins, and so enzymes become even more important, though they're not guaranteed to deactivate the neurotoxins. In their mission to chase after waste matter, liver enzymes also have the ability to collect it again and bring it back to the liver, where it can be contained in a storage bin. Keep in mind that you can have an early liver condition that's not accompanied by elevated liver enzymes on a test. In truth, the liver enzyme flares are still present. Even with the mildest of liver preconditions, the liver is sending out enzymes. Today's blood tests just don't pick them up unless they're really elevated. And remember, tests are only geared to detect a few enzymes when there are really dozens. Another factor that can keep enzyme levels lower in the blood is when the liver calls for enzymatic activity to devour toxins inside of it. By taking care of the problems at the site, the liver has only minor needs to send enzymes out looking for escaped materials, so they don't show up on blood tests. Given that liver enzymes and the undiscovered chemical compounds are highly active, it means the liver doesn't consider them waste. When it lets them go for a reason. Medical research and science, meanwhile, believe that liver enzymes are only released when liver cells are broken, damaged, or exploded, or when they die, without even understanding why cells become disturbed, injured, or otherwise damaged. They usually cast it off as a natural liver process and enzymes as byproduct, when the truth is, that there's much deeper meaning behind it. They don't realise the complex signalling and scavenging that's really going on.
By the way, liver enzymes are not released solely when the liver is hurt, which explains why you can have elevated liver enzymes with no apparent injury to the liver.
You could have no symptoms, no liver damage, no condition or precondition developing at all, and yet you could get a reading of elevated enzymes out of nowhere because a toxic build-up of waste escaped the liver and it released enzymes to do their scavenging and clean-up. If this were a 10,000-page book, we'd have the space we need to describe the ins and outs of the liver's enzymes and specialised chemical compounds in full detail. What enzyme tests have to offer? I support testing for liver enzymes because it can indicate that someone's dealing with a hidden liver condition that otherwise no one would know about, even if it leads to a misdiagnosis or the best treatment plan isn't offered. When considering test results, though, we need to be aware that the testing remains extremely basic. For one, the test results don't come back saying what is wrong, ever. Doctors are left to look for visible signs of an issue, and if scans don't come back showing an obvious obstruction, growth or pocket of scar tissue in plain view, they're stuck in a guessing game. I've also seen hundreds of cases over the years of people who got back elevated enzyme results and did display something physical going on with their liver, whether a tumour, cyst or scar tissue. And yet, that issue wasn't really what was causing their symptoms. To understand why they had fatigue, aches and pains, vertigo, weakness, depression or anxiety, they had to understand what we're exploring in this audiobook. For early signs and symptoms of liver disease, look no further than prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, hypoglycemia, blood sugar imbalances, eczema and psoriasis, weight gain, chemical sensitivities, brain fog, SAD, accelerated aging, methylation issues, hormone imbalances, bloating, gout, dark under eye circles, varicose and spider veins, cellulite, fluid retention, lymphedema, swollen hands and feet, SIBO, and even low hydrochloric acid in the stomach. These are all liver-related, and there are so many more, like the numerous symptoms of a virus camping out in the liver. Some people I've talked with who had these symptoms and conditions got back elevated enzyme results, and some showed enzymes at normal levels. A lot of people with type 2 diabetes don't show elevated enzymes, and a lot of people do. Either way, diabetes stems from the liver. Gout is a serious liver condition, and it's a crapshoot as to whether elevated enzymes will appear on tests or not. Many people dealing with weight gain do show elevated enzyme levels, and many people don't, even when they have a pre-fatty or fatty liver. Elevated enzymes can come and go even within a week or a month, all of it hinging on what the liver is dealing with in a given moment. If liver enzyme tests were taken for days in a row, one test could barely show them. A test 3 days later could show a drastic elevation, and then 2 days later they could be gone. The results you get on your liver enzyme test depend so much on which day you walk into the doctor's office. Is it the day they're up, down, or in between? Since it's a one-and-done situation, with no readings on consecutive days for comparison, you can't know. Despite all this, we can't discount the use of liver enzyme tests. As I said, when tests come back showing elevated enzymes, it's an indication to look more carefully and take better care of our livers, through whatever avenue we choose. What we need to keep in mind is that, like all testing, it's never 100% flawless and accurate. We've learned this with testing for Lyme disease and human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. Many people are given a positive for HIV, get tested again, and receive a negative. It's commonplace. Lyme testing is the same. For more on this, see thyroid healing. It's similar with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. RA testing, too. They're tests geared to look for inflammation or an elevated immune system without identifying why the immune system is in overdrive or why inflammation is occurring. You could end up with the wrong conclusions because interpreting the test results is guesswork. The early bird gets the healthy liver. Even when the tests do their job of showing something amiss, we can't rely on them as the only indicators of liver trouble. We can't live our lives like Noah, hoping everything's fine, relying on a liver enzyme test to be our wake-up call. And we don't want to be worse off than Noah either, living with a liver condition that never shows up on a test and never gives us a wake-up call. You don't want to be that patient with diabetes, weight gain, gout, or even a chronic and low-grade viral infection such as EBV that can create ME, CFS, or Hashimoto's thyroiditis, who doesn't start taking care of herself or himself until getting a reading of elevated liver enzymes at age 50, 60, or 70. Rather than waiting and wondering what pesky or life-threatening health problems could arise for us, we need to be proactive and self-reliant. We need to learn to read the signs and symptoms of liver-related distress. We need to beat the tests to the punch. When it comes to the liver, we want the early bird special. Chapter 10. Dirty Blood Syndrome. Almost everyone on the planet is mildly to chronically dehydrated throughout childhood and adult life. The body has an amazing ability to adapt to this. Or rather, one hard-working organ inside the body that we live most of our lives ignoring has an amazing ability to adapt. Not that it's easy for the liver to get us through decades of dehydration. A person who's chronically dehydrated walks around always on the verge of exhibiting serious and immediate symptoms because the liver is so overextended. Whether those symptoms come to pass depends on the individual's constitution. What makes a good constitution, though? You'll hear it chalked up to genes, that someone with a weaker constitution didn't luck out in the gene lottery, and someone with more robust health did. That's not how it works. That reasoning only distracts us from what a good constitution really depends on. Fewer toxins in the body contributing to stronger organs, creating fewer health vulnerabilities and compromises. A weak constitution is the result of more toxins in the body contributing to struggling organs, creating more vulnerabilities and compromises. If someone has a build-up of toxins in the body and one or more low-grade viral or bacterial infections, chronic dehydration will create more of a strain for that person's system. They'll set someone up to cross that fine line where chronic dehydration suddenly becomes life-disrupting. For example, if you have a low-grade bacterial infection of strep, which you may not know you have, chronic dehydration could be the difference between feeling fine and developing another urinary tract infection, UTI, sinus infection, case of gastritis, sty, SIBO, or even a breakout of acne. Medical communities remain unaware that strep bacteria are chronic in so many and that these conditions are strep-related. If you have a low-grade viral infection, again, which you may not be aware you have, chronic dehydration could also mean the difference between going about your life as usual versus suddenly developing a bout of serious fatigue, aches and pains, tinnitus, vertigo, tingles and numbness, dizziness, confusion, or heart palpitations. Why should you care about chronic dehydration if you feel okay? If you don't have a known liver problem, a low-grade viral or bacterial condition, allergies, migraines, or any of the numerous other symptoms and conditions that dehydration can worsen, why should it matter to you? First, because you may not know you have a problem. Medical testing doesn't yet detect every issue under the surface. And second, because when we're not careful, chronic dehydration gets everyone in the end. It's the straw that breaks the camel's back, causing a stroke at age 65 when the blood gets too thick and polluted after too little hydration over too many decades. It's that tip over the edge that causes a heart attack, even though you've exercised your whole life. You felt good, went on cruises, played golf, had fun, worked hard, became successful. And after all that, the stroke or heart attack triumphed over you. Chronic dehydration won. Well, we can't let chronic dehydration win in the end. The type of dehydration I'm talking about is not a once-in-a-while type, like forgetting to bring a water bottle with you on a long walk. This is an everyday type of dehydration. It happens all the time to students rushing between classes, workers busy at the office, and people running around on errands. At times, it will rear its head. Take, for example, teenagers, who spend a day shopping. Not eating for 3 to 4 hours or more, they'll start to get dizzy and confused with headaches, blurry eyes, slightly faint feelings, and even the shakes, since chronic dehydration can cause blood sugar to drop radically. That's how fine the line can be. All it took was a full morning of shopping to bring on symptoms. The soda and slice of pizza that the shoppers grab in the middle of the day may momentarily give them relief. It's not enough to fix the years and years of chronic dehydration. It only adds to it. We know to fear dehydration in extreme circumstances. It's the spectre that hangs over hikes through the desert and life rafts drifting in the ocean and emergencies that cut people off from resources. What we don't take seriously enough, because we're not aware of how serious it is the only slightly friendlier ghost of chronic dehydration that sits behind a two-way mirror watching us, living with us, and causing trouble that we can't see. It's not so spooky at the beginning, though it can get us in the end. It's like that friend you've had for a very long time with whom you've always gotten along just well enough, until one day he does something just jarring enough that you can't get over it. Chronic dehydration is always riding your back, and it's been there for so long that you don't feel it anymore. If over several months you finally got properly hydrated, then let progress slip and went back to your old ways, you would feel that chronic dehydration return like a monkey on your back, and you wouldn't like carrying it around one bit. We don't learn to hydrate. We learn instead, when we're young, that a cookie and a Dixie cup of apple juice are all we need to get through a whole afternoon at daycare or preschool. While apple juice is good if it's organic and preservative-free, a few sips aren't enough to get a toddler through several hours of playtime, yet that's been a normal practice for decades. Throughout childhood, adolescence, and into adulthood, we learn and relearn similar lessons. When we have our own kids, we unknowingly teach and reteach them that it's okay to get by in life dehydrated. The difference when we are hydrated is astonishing. Like playing a game in the pool, carrying someone on your shoulders back and forth, from end to end, over and over, and then finally offloading the player after a winning slam dunk and feeling the weight lift away. That's what getting hydrated is like. If you're struggling with a chronic symptom or condition of any kind, whether it's been diagnosed properly or it's a mystery, getting hydrated could make a world of difference in your experience of that health issue. Our eating and drinking habits that are part of our normal way of life here on Earth are not pro-blood sugar stabilization, nor are they pro-repair and reversal of chronic dehydration. The fluid choices that people make are almost never adequate to truly hydrate. Yes, I'm even talking to you, exercise enthusiasts, who drink a fancy electrolyte beverage after a long run. Don't think that did the job. Many people who make exercise a big part of their lives are chronically dehydrated. People's diets overall aren't hydrating enough. Add to that alcohol and random pharmaceuticals, as well as the low-quality salt and preservatives that slip into so many foods, and it's a recipe for extreme dehydration every single day. When you wake up in the morning, do you drink a litre of lemon water? Very few people do. It's an ideal protocol to protect you and keep you hydrated, even when you're consuming your normal food and beverages throughout the day. That lemon water first thing could be enough to carry you. So could a celery juice or a smoothie, well, depending on what's in the smoothie. If it's a trendy recipe, chances are it's dehydrating because it's filled with radical fat like tablespoons of coconut oil, nut butter, or whey protein powder and barely any fruit. Trendy smoothies aren't the only dehydrating morning routines. So are the traditional breakfast foods that people grow up on, like bacon, eggs, and toast, with a glass of milk and maybe the processed, pasteurized, preservative-loaded orange juice of the old days. And how about coffee? So many people drink their morning cup of coffee, and that's all they rely on before they head off to work. It may be lunchtime before they put anything else in their bodies. For many of us, over time, our liver cells adapt to never getting proper hydration. Through a miraculous, unknown chemical function that I call the camel effect, our livers are able to keep the rest of our bodies hydrated in the long term. It's not perfect hydration. It's not ideal. It is, while it lasts, life-sustaining. Even when it's bombarded by troublemakers, your liver takes in whatever little bits of high-quality fluid you randomly eat and drink. Like the good sponge it is. It lives in wait for these moments when you do something good for yourself, even if it's by accident. Maybe 6 months ago, your aunt or grandmother offered you an apple, something you'd never eat otherwise. Your liver took advantage. It took advantage of the romaine lettuce salad you ate last week at the block party and the navel orange that a friend shared with you while you were watching your kids' soccer practice. Your liver identifies molecules of living water from fruit, vegetables and leafy greens as unique and scarce passers-by in the bloodstream, grabbing onto them as if it's a child in an Easter egg hunt who's just found the eggs with the prizes inside. Next, your liver stores these molecules of water for the droughts to come. This time, like a child who stashes her or his Halloween candy and ekes it out for weeks, your liver knows that it's the human condition that we don't often do a heck of a lot to hydrate the body properly. This goes back millennia. Hydration isn't always an easy option. The resources aren't always there. And so, in the liver's wisdom, it compresses the precious bioactive water molecules, concentrating them. When you take in liquids from soda or coffee or black tea or other dehydrating sources, your liver releases some of the stored and highly concentrated bioactive water molecules so that they touch the inactive water's contaminated, overfiltered, or otherwise dead molecules, using the inactive molecules to expand the active, concentrated ones and pass along information, in the process transforming the inactive water into a vibrant, activated, living source. This transformed water can then do its good throughout your body, hydrating other organs such as your heart and brain as it travels through the rest of your bloodstream. You've been relying on the camel effect for ages without knowing it. It's how you can go for so many years chronically dehydrated, as so many people do. Once again, you have your liver to thank for your survival. What if the liver starts to falter? It does take a cleaner, better working, more hydrated liver to maintain the ability to pass along concentrated, bioactive water molecules to hydrate the blood. It needs to be a liver that's still upholding its ability to naturally detox and deal with the onslaught of typical troublemakers that are always visiting. If we're not looking out for ourselves, on the other hand, the miraculous camel effect chemical function slowly starts to disappear. If we've had a poor diet and poor hydration methods from a young age, it can disappear earlier in life. If we were lucky enough to be handed more fruits and vegetables and fewer dehydrating items when we were kids, the camel effect could last longer. Either way, at a certain point, when the liver gets sluggish, weakened or otherwise compromised, and pushed for too many years with too little hydration, its ability to adapt and protect us with this chemical function diminishes. The liver becomes so stagnant that poisons back up into the bloodstream and lymphatic system, and this, my friend, is an equation for what I call dirty blood syndrome. Our blood is very complicated. So complicated that if we believe that we, as a society, know every mystery it contains, we're sadly mistaken. If we believe medical research and science have discovered all of the millions of chemical functions occurring within our blood, we're losing it. If we believe that the entire array of hormones that travel through our blood has been found, we're in great denial. And if we believe that the vast, universal circle of immune cells and beneficial microorganisms that are part of the inner workings of our blood has been found, discovered, and understood, then we're really just lost. Simply the truth that our blood is dirtied by scores of toxins would spin the heads of lab scientists. If only they knew what floats in our blood, it would take multiple blood panels to view just a fraction of what dirty blood has to offer science and research as a window into what causes human suffering. Our blood is a river you certainly wouldn't want to drink out of, unless you